Good morning. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine. As June is Walk and Bike to Work a Month, we'll check in with Sue Prant of Community Cycles in Boulder on how we're doing in creating an infrastructure that encourages more alternative modes of transit. Then, the Colorado legislature passed a so-called red flag law that would allow the removal of guns from a person who's deemed a threat to themselves or others. Well, it's not the first in the country, nor is it the first to receive pushback from local communities. We'll get some national context with Matt Vasligambros, who's a reporter for Stateline. That's a news service funded by the Pew Charitable Trusts, and he's been looking at similar laws around the country. On Resistance Radio, we'll hear about how young children are being trained to become protectors of bees. Jen Cornell speaks with one local educator who's teaching young children on why we need to protect the bees and how we can do it. After headlines from the BBC at the bottom of the hour, we'll have a brand new commentary from Jim Hightower, followed by a public affair. And this morning, host Frank Dubofsky speaks with Boulder County District Attorney Mike Doherty. At 9 o'clock, it is media analysis from Counterspin, rounding out this morning's news and public affairs. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Jamie Sudler.
Governor Jared Polis signed two bills into law on Friday, both of which seek to improve the lives of gay and transgender people in the state. In a ceremony outside the Capitol with dozens of supporters, Polis signed a measure that makes it easier for transgender people to change their birth certificates without having to go through gender reassignment surgery. The Colorado Sun reports that the other bill he signed bans so-called gay conversion therapy for minors. About that bill, Boulder Democrat Steve Fenberg said at the signing that Colorado is now officially saying that being gay does not need to be cured, and it's not a disease that you need to see someone for. Instead, he continued, something to be celebrated and accepted and welcomed with open arms. The transgender birth certificate measure is called Jude's Law after a transgender teen who has been testifying for years about the issue, starting when she was 9, in support of the bill. Daniel Ramos, who heads One Colorado, an LGBTQ advocacy group, said that the signing of the bills is not only a historic moment for Colorado, but also for the country to see a number of LGBTQ elected officials and Colorado's first openly gay governor signing the pro-LGBTQ legislation. This evening, One Colorado will release its most recent LGBTQ health report. Sarah Doglish has more.
The report is entitled Closing the Gap, the Turning Point for LGBTQ Health, and includes data from surveys taken in 2018. It identifies obstacles that members of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender and queer community face in Colorado. One of the main challenges for many LGBTQ Coloradans is access to health care. Though the Affordable Care Act eliminated being transgender as a pre-existing condition, One Colorado found that 34% of transgender people in the state have been denied coverage for gender-related care. The report also found that conversion therapy is still surprisingly prevalent in Colorado. In the survey, 1 in 5 LGBTQ people said someone had tried to change their gender identity or sexual orientation. One Colorado says that these findings represent a larger trend of pushback against LGBTQ healthcare and rights that has occurred under the Trump administration. For instance, a proposal announced by the administration last week would prevent gender identity from being included in sex discrimination. One Colorado, which is a statewide LGBTQ advocacy group, will release the full report today at an event from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at Mile High United Way, 711 Park Avenue, West Denver. For KGNU, I'm Sarah Dalgleish.
Today, the Boulder County Commissioners will consider an amended plan to phase out the production of genetically modified foods on about 25,000 acres of publicly owned cropland. The county adopted a policy in 2017 that would have phased out some GMO production this year, but the modified plan proposed by open space staff calls for a delay in curtailing the growth of the crops. GMO corn was to be phased out by the end of this year and sugar beets by 2021. Last month, a modified timeline was put forward by Philip Taylor of a group named Mad Agriculture. Now the commissioners will consider the latest version of that plan, which was released just last Thursday. The modified deadline for GMO corn would be 2021, with a 4-year extension for sugar beets. The Daily Camera reports that some residents want a complete conversion to organic farming on county land. Mary Smith of Longmont and the founder of an advocacy group called GMO No, spelled KNOW, said that the commissioners are trying to alter the policy to ban GMOs on which they were elected. She also said there has been a lack of sufficient resident input. But county officials deny that there has been any inadequate notice of the process. The county commissioner's public hearing will start at 4 p.m. this afternoon at the Boulder County Courthouse at 1325 Pearl Street. Tomorrow is Election Day in Denver. Incumbent Mayor Michael Hancock is in a runoff against challenger Jamie Gillis. There is also an initiative to ban spending of public funds on any Olympic bid unless voters give their approval. Late last week, it was revealed that one of Hancock's appointees has submitted his resignation. Ryan Broughton had been the executive director of the Denver Office of Emergency Management. Westward reports that sources say he resigned amidst allegations of gender bias and the creation of a hostile work environment. Broughton's resignation was tendered on May 13th and is effective this coming Friday. The newspaper reports that people weren't supposed to learn about Broughton's resignation prior to tomorrow's election. However, a spokesman for the mayor denied that the election had anything to do with public information about the Broughton resignation. The spokesperson did confirm that he is the target of an official inquiry. During the campaign, Hancock has faced issues about his own conduct in sending inappropriate texts to a female police officer, for which he has apologized. Ballots in the election were mailed out earlier last month, and it is too late to mail them in, but they can be turned in up till 7 p.m. tomorrow night. People can also vote in person until 7 p.m. tomorrow at a vote center. Democrats in the Greeley area have selected Mary Young to replace former State Representative Rochelle Galindo, who resigned last month. Young is a school psychologist who will now represent District 50 in the State House of Representatives. She is the wife of State Treasurer Dave Young, who was a member of the committee to replace Galindo, but he recused himself from the vote to select his wife. Today looks to be sunny this morning with increasing clouds and a chance of afternoon showers and storms and a high of about 82. Tomorrow mostly sunny with the high near 80. Right now it's about 64 along the Front Range. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
It's 11 minutes past 8 o'clock. Well, June is Walk and Bike to Work Month, and it's a month where alternative modes of transportation are being encouraged. Bike and Walk to Work Day happens on June 26th, but throughout all of this month, we're going to be hosting discussions on what it looks like to have other modes of transit available and encouraged as we're facing a climate crisis, and transportation can play a key role in that. Well, a lack of infrastructure is making it a challenge for many communities to really change from a car-focused community to a bike or pedestrian mode community. Here in Boulder, there have been changes to biking infrastructure. I checked in with Sue Prant of Community Cycles in Boulder on how we're doing in terms of creating an infrastructure that encourages people to get out of their cars and get on their bikes.
I would say that Boulder is getting there. There are places in the United States where there are more miles of protected bike lanes, and that is really the thing that we need. Protected bike lanes are the thing that we need to get people of all ages and abilities out on bicycles. I just spent, 2 weeks in the Netherlands, and wherever you go, there's protected bike lanes. So the number of people bicycling far exceeds the number of people driving cars. And if you really want to make that change to a society where more people are biking and it's the norm, and meeting our climate goals as we try in many ways to do in Boulder at great expense, then we really need to provide complete facilities for bicycles. And that means in small and large cities in the Netherlands, everywhere you go, their bicycles always accommodate on every street. And so what we have now is we do have a network, and we're making improvements to the network, and we're filling in missing links, which is incredibly important. So I think that will have us get there. But if we really want a major cultural change, and I believe that cities in the United States can have this major cultural change, then bicycling needs to be as accommodated as automobiles. But in the meantime, I think that the city of Boulder is making a lot of strides and really looking for better accommodation, looking to fill those missing links, and looking to make facilities that people of all ages and abilities can ride on. we will, until we make a huge commitment to change every street and change our land use so that people are living closer to their destinations and we have more density, it's always going to be an uphill battle. But I do believe that things are getting better and we're getting there. But our vision at Community Cycles and many people in the community is for bicycling to be a fully accepted equal mode and to be fully safe.
What progress then have we seen? Have we seen the introduction of more protected bike lanes in the last 12 months?
So we have a few more that are on the road. There is last year, I think it was last year, up on the diagonal, just in the little boulder part of the diagonal from 30th to the end of the city there on going east. There is a protected bike lane that's new. Unfortunately, because of where it is, it's not something that's used a ton. We have a great plan for 30th Street. And when we do get the funding to redo 30th Street, which is a major corridor for bicycles in this town, because once you go west of 30th Street, you have to go all the way to Folsom to get another through street for bicycles. That will be an awesome facility. But we don't have funding for it. It's many years out. But the plans for it were completed in this past year, and the plans were really excellent. And I commend the city and their consultants for a great job done on the planning process and the community input and everything around the 30th Street corridor. And that's something that Community Cycles has been working to get 30th Street to be a safer facility for quite a long time.
Well, Boulder, like many American cities, was built with the cars as the primary mode of transportation. And so it's very car-centric if you look at the urban design, even to the detriment of pedestrians course then bicycles. So it would seem that it would be quite a challenge to retrofit that. And in a city that we're maybe not building new roads, you know, that would be a challenge. I mean, in communities, we're seeing the growth of suburbs, of course, and there's so much urban development. Are we seeing bicycles as being considered as key in the transportation infrastructure in say new building?
I would say yes, to a degree. So in the city of Boulder, when we build something new, we do look to accommodate bicycles better than we have in the past. In the surrounding area, you will often see bicycles accommodated through a multi-use path and bike parking and things like that, because the ordinances are in pretty much statewide that you have to do that. The problem is that the land use does not connect where this new development is to where people actually need to go on bicycles. So if your land use is such that you have to cover great stretches of fast roads, then no matter how bicycle friendly you make your little neighborhood out in the middle of suburbia, it's not a viable option for people to use a bike much, because most trips are outside of your neighborhood. In Boulder, we could accommodate bicycles better by having more infill and more density, because we still have an awful lot of people driving in. So we still have 60,000 people driving in. So that's what's creating the traffic that is creating the conflicts with bicycles and pedestrians. If we were able to at least accommodate some of that those people coming into the city with places for them to live affordably in Boulder, then we would have less infill traffic. So, you know, it's all connected. And but yes, we are doing better jobs in creating facilities when we build new things, but often at this point in time, they can be islands in and of themselves.
I mean, I suppose public transit plays a key role in that, because if you were working and living in completely different communities, at least if you have the opportunity to bring your bicycle easily to, you know, your end location, that's an opportunity. And I know some of the RTD buses do have bike racks, but very limited. I mean, I think you can only bikes in the front of most buses.
You can only fit two. So that's where, you know, you hear a lot of talk about the first and final mile trips. So that's in a lot of places where things like bike share and dockless bike share and the e-scooters and things like that have come about in this country as mobility options to to solve that first and final mile and to make transit more usable.
Well, there are a lot of events happening in Bike to Work Month. Of course, June 26th is Bike to Work Day. KGNU will be hosting a breakfast station and have lots of special programming that day. There'll be many throughout the city of Boulder. But what are some of the events to look out for during the month of June?
So if you go to our website, which is walkandbikemonth.org, and that's the website for the month in the city of Boulder, you'll find the locations of all the breakfast stations. There are at least 50 that have signed up so far. And that's on June 26th, as we said. There are other events. There's plenty of great walks around town sponsored by Boulder Walks. So there's short walks, there's long walks, and with lots of learning going on with those walks. There's a Boulder Bike Show, which is a popular event. This is our third year. We do the Rayback, so people bring their tricked out bikes and get awards, and people vote on the best bike. We have some adaptive events. We have an art tour on bicycle done by Shared Paths, which is another local group of ours. And Community Cycles has our annual member party on June 22nd. And at our member party, you'll get to see our new space. You can join for and become a Community Cycles member for a discount rate and come see our new space. It's at 2601 Spruce. And we just moved there this year, and it's a big improvement over our previous location.
That's Sue Prant, who is with Community Cycles. They're offering a whole host of classes throughout the month of June as well, and you can find out more about them at communitycycles.org. And once again, to find out about all the events that are happening throughout the month of June, including on June 26th, go to walkandbikemonth.org. Now, that's for the city of Boulder. There are many other communities that are celebrating Bike to Work Month and Day. And so you can go to biketoworkday.us and find out where the breakfast stations will be in your community and some of the other events. And we'll be putting more information online at kgnu.org. We'll also be hosting a lot more conversations on what it means to have different modes of transportation available to all of us in our community. That will be throughout the month of June. Well, Colorado is one of the most recent states to enact a so-called red flag law. But a majority of counties here say they won't actually enforce it. While the laws vary from state to state, there really aren't any major differences. Matt Vaslegambros is a reporter for Stateline. That's a news service that's funded by the Pew Charitable Trusts. And he's reported on similar red flag laws in places around the country. He spoke with Abigail Beckman.
So opponents of this law say taking someone's firearms away because they may be a threat to themselves or others is a violation of due process and Second Amendment rights. Is that similar to what has been said or argued elsewhere?
Yeah, right now it's up to about 200 counties across 9 states that are denouncing any sort of gun legislation, saying that they're not going to enforce it.
Can a sheriff or a county really choose not to enforce something that is now the law?
Right. So this gets into kind of a legally tricky scenario where, you know, if you jaywalk, a cop has a choice to give you a ticket or not. If you got pulled over for speeding, you could get a warning or you can get a ticket. They have the discretion to do what they'd like since they are the law enforcement officer. So in this case, they say, well, our citizens in mostly rural areas are responsible gun owners, and it's a burdensome law for our community, so we have the discretion not to enforce it because we're not dealing with the same issues in, say, Denver than they are in rural areas of the state.
But are there any consequences for that?
So a lot of this has been bluster. There hasn't been a specific case in which a sheriff has refused to carry out one of these red flag orders from a judge. But certain officials in other states have made it clear that if you do not enforce this law and something happens where someone gets injured because a law was not enforced, that sheriff will be held legally responsible. The Washington State Attorney General recently came out with a statement that said as much. Now, other legal experts that I spoke to said that to hold a sheriff liable is a fantasy. That, again, it goes back to this discretion issue. So if it comes to a point where there's some sort of legal case, I think then maybe the courts will decide whether or not they have the right to do that. But as of right now, you have sheriffs and county officials across the country saying that they're not going to enforce some of these laws.
So following along that kind of same vein, this word sanctuary, the use of that has been kind of interesting. Some counties here have chosen specifically not to include that word, but others have been intentional on including it. What significance does that term have?
Really, the term picked up in Illinois, where officials downstate were frustrated with these new gun laws that they said were written because of the problems in Chicago. And Illinois is a very big state, and problems in rural areas are not the same in urban areas. And so basically this one county said, you know, we want to spice up our legislation. And since the sanctuary term is a big buzzword and Chicago is a sanctuary city for immigrants, we're going to co-opt that. And we're going to say we are a sanctuary for gun rights. So it's more of a thumb in the eye to say that while you may be protecting the rights of immigrants, we're protecting the rights of gun owners in our communities.
We know all too well here in Colorado that we are not immune to gun violence, even in recent weeks with the shooting at a school in Highlands Ranch. The Columbine Massacre here just marked its 20th anniversary, and the Aurora Theater shooting took place here in 2012. This kind of legislation really gained traction, though, following the Parkland shooting in Florida. What have the arguments been in favor?
Well, you know, some lawmakers and law enforcement officers clearly say that this saves lives. I talked to a sheriff out here on the East Coast in Montgomery County, Maryland, who told me that since Maryland passed their red flag law, in the first 4 months, they had nearly 400 petitions to remove weapons from people. And he said five of those involved a potential school shooting. So, you know, he was very intent on saying that in his community, he believes these laws have been life-saving. And this kind of legislation, like you said earlier, couldn't have been passed if it weren't for those student activists in Parkland. You know, if you look at school shootings, like you said, since Columbine or even the Sandy Hook shooting at the elementary school, there was a lot of call for action, but there wasn't a lot of action at the state level. And a good argument could be made that if it weren't for those student activists, that the momentum that we see now in states red and blue wouldn't have come to fruition. And I mean, to that point, many of the new red flag laws were signed by Republican governors. So it's not necessarily just a Democratic issue. There is some bipartisan support for some of these measures.
That's Matt Vaslagambrose, who's a reporter for Stateline. That's a new service funded by Pew Charitable Trusts. And he's reported on red flag laws in place around the country. He spoke there with Abigail Beckman of our sister station, KRCC. Well, now on Resistance Radio, we're going to hear from a local educator who's teaching young children to resist the decline in our bee populations. KGNU's Jen Cornell has more.
I have Dee Dee Pazur here with me today. Dee Dee is a teacher and librarian over at Fireside Elementary School in Louisville, Colorado. Dee Dee has been a beekeeper for a few years and has been doing beesentations with her students. So Dee Dee, can you please tell me about these beesentations?
Sure. So the beesentations are an opportunity for me to share my experience with the miracle of bees with our younger generations, because our environment is not in great shape right now, and we're really looking toward the children to help reverse the damage that we adults have done to the planet so far. So really personifying the bees, letting the kids see them as these miraculous individuals and groups that not only pollinate our food and create honey, but just represent this huge, hardworking, behind-the-scenes crew, and just making them more aware that bees are not scary, stinging insects, but that bees are hugely helpful to us. And without them, our lives would be very, very different. And certainly our diets would be very, very different. So we talk about a lot of different things, and then we get to the subject of my personal heartbreak, which was the colony collapse that I experienced after 3 years of beekeeping. So the teachers at Uni Hill had requested that I talk about colony collapse, and the kids then, after hearing about, you know, toxins and lack of forage and being transported for commercial uses, the varroa mites, diseases, and then we have the kids brainstorm some ways that they could help bees in their own small away. And what they always come to the conclusion of is that the easiest thing they could do, two easiest things really, one, ask their parents not to use toxic chemicals in maintaining any sort of gardens. And then two, creating more forage for bees to make sure that they have enough pollen and nectar to sustain themselves. And we always end up getting to the point of talking about guerrilla ecology and how the kids could plant seeds and create more pollen and nectar bearing plants for bees. And always in the past, we've ended up talking about seed bombs, which are a composite of clay, dirt, and seeds that are compacted with water. And they can be thrown into any sort of empty field area or along the highway. And when it rains, they'll have their own food source and they'll be able to sprout right there. We've always talked about that. This year, the Uni Hill teachers decided that they would create those seed bombs as their culminating experience of this project. And it was just really exciting to see the kids get excited. And I'm really hoping that in talking to the Uni Hill kids, talking to the Fireside kids, that those kids will talk to other kids, that we will have a generation that is far more aware of our impact on the environment and what we can do to help those helpful creatures that we so rely upon.
Excellent. Can you explain to me how the students and the parents and the teachers react to your presentations?
The parents in the Fireside community will talk to me and say, I heard about your bees. My kids want to get a beehive. We actually do have some parents who either already had beehives or were considering having a suburban beehive and have since had that experience, and will sometimes ask me questions about my own experience for tips and tricks. So yeah, I would say the parents are just excited that their kids are excited. And then the teachers at Uni Hill are so complimentary, and then they get just as eager as the kids to hear about the bees. They've grown to love the bees too. And then the kids had a fourth grade group of girls who came to me, and they had formed a bee saving club, and they were going around with sugar water and finding bees that looked like they were tired or struggling. And they were giving sugar water, and they made little houses out of dandelions. And so they were washing off dandelions and building little houses for the bees. So the kids are a lot more aware, and I have a lot of hope for our future knowing that these kids are going to be a big part of that.
Beautiful. Well, thank you for all the work you're doing with the bees and with the kids, and best of luck to you. For KGNU, this is Jen Cornell.